This is the British Broadcasting Corporation. We present London Forum, a weekly program in which we bring to the microphone prominent personalities to discuss important topics of the day. This week, three young Americans who have only recently arrived in Britain put questions to two British speakers about aspects of British policy on which they believe people in the United States would like more information. Here is Anna Balfour, a woman journalist on the London staff of Time magazine, to introduce the speakers.
This is Anna Balfour in the studios of the BBC in London, introducing this week's London Forum. Now, we're going to try and do something that we hope is going to be both interesting and probably fun and games, as well as perhaps useful. I know there are a lot of questions about British politics, foreign affairs and domestic, which raise a good deal of curiosity in the United States. And therefore we have gathered round us this evening three young Americans who are over here in London, and we've asked them to put short questions to a distinguished socialist and a distinguished member of the Conservative Party, and we probably expect to get a fight as a result. We hope something useful as well. Now, the three Americans whom we have here are, first of all, Talcott Williams, who is a graduate of Columbia University. Talcott, tell us, what are you doing here at the moment?
Madam Chairman, I've been in England now a little over a month, and I'm looking into various aspects of the nationalized industries, particularly with the relation to the question of workers' control of industry.
Good. Well, I expect you'll be giving us some questions on that later on. And then we have William McNeil, who is assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. Now, perhaps, Mr. McNeil, you'd tell us what you're doing here and how long you've been in this country.
I've been here a little bit longer than Mr. Williams, 3 months, to be exact. And what I'm trying to do is write a book on the Allied relations during the World War from 1941 to 46.
Mm-hmm. And then our third is Anne Wells, who is a graduate student at Radcliffe College, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Anne, you are doing what?
Well, I'm here in England at a Rotary Foundation Fellowship, so I'm combining speaking to Rotary clubs with doing some research on political education in the Labour and Conservative parties.
It almost makes me wish I could join a Rotary Club. Well, now we come to the two who have the onerous job of answering these questions. First, we have Francis Williams, a socialist. Francis Williams was editor of the Daily Herald from 1936 to 1940, and then he was public relations officer to Prime Minister Mr. Astley from 1945 to 47. Now, Francis, what, you know America pretty well, don't you?
Yes, I spent most of last year there, and although I was stationed mainly in Washington, I did in fact travel right across the country, talking to all sorts and kinds of people, and very fascinating and also very hopeful, I found that.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, now you're writing for the News Chronicle, so that you're able to explain a good deal to our people of what you found there.
Yes, although not exclusively on American subjects. Mm-hmm.
And then we have on the other side of the table our Conservative representative, Lord Hailsham, who is better known in this country and I think also in America as Quintin Hogg, who for 12 years was Conservative Member of Parliament for the city of Oxford. Now, the odd thing is that although he was a very prominent voter in the House of Commons, the poor man at this present time has no vote in this country of ours. I wonder if you could explain that to us, could you?
Well, I don't know that I can explain it. I can confirm it. Peers, felons, bankrupts, lunatics, and children and dons are deprived of their votes and all their political rights. Except in the case of peers, they're allowed to congregate together in the House of Lords. And there I now congregate with others of my kind.
Well, now you know something about the privileges of the, quote, privileged, unquote, classes. Well, now let's get to these questions. Talcott Williams, I think perhaps you would like to lead off, would you?
I'd like to very much, Madam Chairman. And my first question is addressed to Francis Williams on a matter that is very much in our minds these days. I think many Americans would like to know why there are not more British troops in Korea at the present moment. And could you tell us something about England's other commitments throughout the world and the reasons, other reasons, for the limited size of force in Korea?
I think that's a question that's very understandable from Americans. I think if I were an American, I should be asking it. But one does have to take into account that Britain is a very important partner in the whole international battle against the spread of communism. In having forces in Malaya, in Hong Kong, in the Middle East, in a great many parts of the world where traditionally we have maintained forces to defend world communications, to hold on to important strategic parts. And I think, although superficially it might have seemed an aid to the United Nations and to America if we had taken more troops from those centers and put them into Korea, in actual fact, it would have been playing the Soviet game. Because it does seem that probably a part of Soviet strategy may well be to try and get a diversion of United Nations troops tied up in Korea to such an extent as to give her greater freedom to move in other parts of the world. Therefore, in this matter, it is very essential to look at the world as a whole, even although, for the moment, Korea is the most urgent and most active part of the battle. Mm-hmm.
Would you really say that the British government has the same commitment in Korea, that there's a full sympathy between the American and British points of view with respect to Korea?
I would say absolutely. I would say there is no difference at all.
You don't think that it's fair to say that the British are defending their empire and letting the Americans fight in Korea?
I would certainly not say that.
Well,
I would say that the whole conception of defense of the empire in that sense is out of date, in that the empire itself is changing and the Commonwealth is becoming a part of the whole strategic front against communism.
Well, I can see Clinton Hogg absolutely itching to jump in on this.
Well, I don't know that I'm itching, but nor would I like to give the impression that I'm really trying to detract from what Williams, I think, has very properly said. Moreover, I think it's fair to add that both the balance of British forces has something to do with it. After all, our manpower is much more wholly committed to the Navy and the Air Force than in most military powers. And also, of course, the necessity for our retaining a strategic reserve here in Europe, which is, after all, the decisive factor in the war against communism. Both these factors ought to be taken into consideration. And it ought to be said, of course, that if you ignore the very gallant Turkish brigade, we are, I think, contributing more than any other power except America to this matter. At the same time, I think I should make this clear, that defense policy generally is not uncontroversial as between the two parties. My own party has offered more criticisms than one of the efficiency of the government in the matter, and we do think perhaps that, without detracting from what Williams has said, that more could have been done. We're not absolutely satisfied.
Well, this leads into the question which I had in the back of my mind. Mr. Hogg, do you think that Great Britain is still a great power, to put it in a rather provocative fashion? Or do you think that, rather, Britain should be a part of a potential European great power? Do you feel that Britain can go it alone any longer?
Nobody, I think, has gone alone in Britain, at any rate since 1914. Our struggle, both in the Kaiser's War and in Hitler's War, has been a joint struggle with other nations. But I think that should give you the clue to your question. We are the smallest of the great powers and the greatest of the small powers. We are nothing without our Commonwealth and Empire, the dominions behind us. We are nothing outside Europe, but we can't play our part in Europe except as an imperial power. The two are inextricably built up with one another. Nor could we play our part vis-à-vis Europe or the Empire except by reason of the fact that whatever you say, we are the first of the English-speaking peoples. We speak English.
I think, in a sense, one wants some definition of what a great power is, and I think that in one important respect, the whole great power concept is out of date. The importance of the great power in the past was of a power able to balance, particularly in Europe, able to maintain a balance between possible conflicting forces. Now, I think any conception of Britain as a great power, either able to or in fact desiring to preserve that kind of balance between, say, America and Russia, is completely out of date. Because in the whole clash between America and Russia, Britain's whole sympathies, her whole mode of life, is absolutely and finally linked up with that of America to an extent that it isn't possible for it to be with Russia in its present state of mood and policy and general ideology. So there is no question of a sort of balancing great power in that sense. But to suggest that Britain is a small power in the sense that she is no longer able or ought to try to influence the course of world policy seems to me again to make a mistake about what a great power consists of. Because a great power doesn't only consist of material strength, although immaterial strength is important. But it does also depend, I think, upon an accumulation of political and international knowledge and experience and understanding. And I think that in that matter, Britain has quite a lot to contribute.
I want to guide this a little bit, as a matter of fact, because just recently in the foreign affairs debate which we've been having in this country, people on both sides of the House have been emphasizing very considerably the extremely close ties that we have with the United States and the urgency to maintain those ties as closely as possible. I think that we're more or less all agreed that we ought to emphasize that in answering this question. And there's another thing which I know my American friends are a little uncertain about, and questions are raised about this, which I think, again, we ought to clear up in this question. Many Americans say to me, but aren't the British rather dragging their feet, as they call it, in Europe, as far as international cooperation is concerned, and also in our relations with the Atlantic Pact? Now, Quentin Hogg, do you want to comment on that?
I think that is a fair criticism, but it's also party controversy in this country. We in the Conservative Party do feel that the government has been altogether too weak in its approach to the Strasbourg institution and altogether too timid in its approach to economic unification. Indeed, we think, if we can venture this criticism, that they have been untrue to their own principles in this respect. We think that they very largely built themselves up as an international party in Europe, and now they have betrayed that principle for the sake of rather a parochial nationalism. And we are sorry to see it.
May I just interject?
Yes, please, on that?
I think the real reply to that is that the Socialist Party, very often unlike the Conservative Party, is a practical party. And it believes in building on practical foundations, rather than making a great edifice on paper, endeavoring to get European cooperation on one small field, which can then develop onto another small field, and remembering all the time that the whole concept of Commonwealth relationship, which is vitally important not merely to Britain but to the whole world, has been built and has developed not on trying to get a hard and fast, rigid federation of any kind, but on a development from practical issues in which common understanding grew naturally and could develop into the machinery necessary to carry them into effect.
Well, there you've had a brief answer from both sides, and they really could go on discussing that one all night. But Anne Wells, I think you have now a question that you want to put.
Yes, I'd like to take this discussion away from the foreign back to the home front for just a moment and ask Mr. Williams if he will define a great power's attitude toward subversive activity. Now, remembering the Fuchs case, which raised questions in the American mind about the laxness of Britain's security regulations, the Sheffield Peace Conference seems to have left us completely confused as to whether or not the Labour government really has a security policy or not. Now, would you please explain just what happened at Sheffield, and would you explain to us how Britain is solving this problem of subversive activity within a free society?
Just let me clarify that a little bit. You really want to know how we maintain our security and yet, as a land of freedom and liberty,
at the same time, maintain free speech. And freedom of association.
Now, Francis.
That is the immense question and the important balance that has to be maintained. During the war, when I was controller of censorship, and I had a great deal to do with security people on all the side of the forces and so on. And the question that always came up then was that, quite understandably, from their point of view, they wanted the absolute limit of security. They wanted to prevent all kinds of information which might conceivably and vaguely be of some interest from coming out. I, on the other side, as representing the civil authority and the public interest as we saw it in this matter, had to try and say it is sometimes worthwhile taking a slight risk on security in order that your whole public shall be informed of what is going on and that you shall not permanently damage the whole liberal, with a small L, basis of a democratic society.